From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how Texans experience violence and how changes at the post office can impact the coming election. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. When violence happens, it's not just a crime. It's also an issue of public health, with long-reaching impacts on economic stability for the survivors. In the first-of-its-kind examination of violence in the lives of Texans, we find that violence is more widespread than what crime data suggest, and that women in Texas are subjected to more violence than in other states. The Texas Violence Experiences Survey is the first statewide survey to capture Texans' lived experiences with violence, including forms rarely reported to police. The survey project was led by Anita Raj, executive director of Tulane University's Newcomb Institute.
At a high level, I would say that the findings really show how pervasive and normative violence in Texas is, or violence against, you know, adults across the lifespan, is in Texas. I don't think that makes Texas unique, but there are some unique aspects about how it plays out there. At the end of the day, I think that what the report really tells you is that crime data is of the iceberg in terms of what experiences of violence people face, and that these experiences have a direct impact on the mental health crisis that we're seeing in our country and in Texas.
And so what do you see as far as how widespread violence is in Texas? And we're talking about just in everyday people's lives or the course of their lives, right?
That's exactly right. So if you look at the data, about half of Texans have experienced physical violence, about half have experienced some form of sexual violence, whether that's sexual harassment, coercion, but yes, assault as well. And about half have experienced intimate partner violence. When you include an intimate partner violence, controlling behaviors and emotional abuse. So at the point you see it like that, you recognize there's really, it's ubiquitous, and it's something that affects men and women. Although certainly we do see that sexual violence and intimate partner violence are more likely to affect women than men.
And that it also begins in people's early in their lives.
About 14 to 15% of Texas adults have experienced physical and sexual violence, respectively, before the age of 13. So we're seeing, you know, pretty notable levels of early in life physical and sexual violence as well.
Would that include, you know, getting whoopings from your parents?
It does. It does. And one of the things that we noticed in Texas is that those whoopings from your parents, as you call them, they happen pretty equivalently for boys and girls. And for, you know, again, we asked this for the adult sample to retrospectively consider what happened when they were young. So it's possible that this has reduced, but sure, that does mean that about 15% you're hearing, you know, it could be spanking or things that you think are normative. I will say that oftentimes people underreport those, so that is potentially less likely to be seen in the data. But we want to kind of note that that's about the same level of people who are reporting sexual violence, harassment, sexual coercion, forced sex. That's about the same percent reporting that in childhood and well as well. And it's pretty equivalent for boys and girls in childhood. In that sense, too. Slightly more likely for girls, but not by much.
Yeah, so there's a huge distinction between a spanking, which is like maybe a swat on the butt, and a whooping, which could include wounds, breaking of skin, bruising, even broken bones.
Yeah, and, you know, that's something that we understand is getting less common, you know, with every generation. And when we count adults, we have everybody 18 and older. So we've got older populations that where it may have been more common. So certainly that's something to consider. But regardless, you're still seeing 15% of Texas adults feel that they have were physically abused as children.
Some people may say, well, there's a huge distinction between being whooped as a child and then having to deal with sexual violence or intimate partner violence and all these other issues of, you know, getting in fights and stuff. But you have to consider the social transmissions of violence. So are all these things interconnected?
Absolutely. That's actually the reason we do the survey the way we do it. We're the only survey that collects various forms of violence across the lifespan so that we can see the interconnection and the intergenerational aspects, as well as seeing what people report in terms of their perpetration or their use of violence against others. And you absolutely see a connection. Those who experienced violence in childhood are more likely to have experienced in adulthood. Those who experienced violence, physical or sexual, are more likely, like if you experience physical violence, you're more likely to have experienced sexual violence. Those who've experienced violence are more likely to perpetrate violence. So that interconnection is really central to how we want to support people to think about this issue. We rely a lot on a criminal justice system that doesn't seem to stop violence. What we've seen in the data, not from my study particular case, but from a variety of studies for many, many years, is that you really want to tackle violence early in life. You want to tackle it, the environmental, the contextual environmental risk factors that can increase risk for violence. That's going to do a lot more to affect violence than the criminal justice system will.
People who have been victimized with violence will have some form of post-traumatic stress from that. That can be exhibited in a number of ways. They can be quick to anger, easily triggered, instability in relationships, instability in able to maintain jobs. So there are downstream harms that can really disrupt a person's life.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to first say that there's like a societal cost to this as well. So we've done, we did an economic study. We had previously done this same study in California and Louisiana, and we did an economic cost of it. And in California, it was about $10.2 billion a year for just intimate partner violence in terms of the cost, largely because of the mental health services that are utilized. Drop in the bucket for the criminal justice ones, because most people don't report the violence that they experience. And that's more than double. It's more than $20 billion a year in costs for intimate partner violence in California. So I would estimate, because the proportions are not too different, the percentages are not too different in experiences of violence in Texas. So I would say that I would estimate that you're somewhere between that in terms of the cost, the economic cost to the state. But absolutely, we know that we are not just losing people who've experienced violence in terms of lives lost from the injuries that they face and sometimes the deaths, direct deaths, but also that there's higher rates of suicidality. And what we're also finding is that men are increasingly reporting that suicidality. We've seen that in our Louisiana and California data. And so, you know, it used to be that we call suicidality did you consider suicide in the past year? Did you seriously consider suicide in the past year? Historically, women were more likely to report that than men, but that's not what we're seeing now. We're actually seeing that men are more likely to report than women, and that's holding true in Texas as well.
In Texas, it's been said that the state was born of violence, that violence is in interwoven with the identity of being a Texan. Does that come into play?
You know, overall, I don't see a whole lot of difference in the prevalence of violence. We have the Louisiana data and the California data out. I don't see that prevalence being so great. Where I do see a real difference is actually, and it's quite notable, if you look at physical violence for the other states, what you see is that experiences of physical violence are just more likely to happen against men than women. That's pretty consistent. And it's particularly true when you look at issues of gun violence. that doesn't hold true for Texas. In Texas, it's actually, it's pretty equivalent with women slightly more likely to have experienced any form of physical violence. And it's pretty equivalent in having experienced violence from a gun. But I can tell you that the who is involved with that violence looks very different for women and men in Texas. For women, it's going to be much more likely that that's going to be a partner. Whereas men, it's going to be a stranger or an acquaintance.
And is this happening across all demographics, all social and economic categories?
There is some variation. A lot of people talk to me about the differences by race and by income, because that's sort of the most pronounced we often will see in the data from crimes, right? Crime data. When we look at past year experiences of violence, because we thought that's most salient to be associated with your current economic situation, for example, what we see is we don't see strong differences by race or by ethnicity. You know, we see the differences is that gay, lesbian, bisexual people, that's a really strong difference. That's a group of people that are much more likely to have experienced violence. Those living with a disability, they are much more likely to have experienced violence. Those with a history of homelessness or incarceration, they are much more likely to have experienced violence. And probably one of the strongest findings we see with regard to that is if you've experienced economic shocks in the last year, you have not enough money for food or basic needs to be met, you've had an eviction, you have experienced homelessness in that past year, you're just going to see much higher rates of that past year physical and sexual violence. Really, I think we need to be looking at what are the vulnerabilities attached to these economic shocks and why our gay, lesbian, bisexual community members and why our people who are living with a disability are so much more at risk. The other group that's more at risk, and this one is not surprising, is the younger you are. What we do see is that, it starts to elevate in adolescence, your risk for violence, and then it's highest among young adults for both physical and sexual violence. And that is something that we also need to be focusing on is, you know, early prevention, working with young populations, because they're the ones most vulnerable.
So when we talk about the social transmission of violence, what are ways that can be interrupted?
I'm so glad you asked about that. I think violence prevention is really key. And I think when you see it at this level, you're not talking about, you know, this is not something that can just be resolved from, well, mental health is important. It cannot just be resolved from individual counseling. It cannot just be resolved from the criminal justice system, because we don't have a lot of people who report a lot of these experiences. We really have to use systemic approaches. So, for example, violence prevention, we think, really needs to be happening in the school systems and in community-based efforts. We know that neighborhood violence corresponds with this. We know that people who have exposures to violence in their households, which cuts across neighborhoods, we're not going to necessarily know what's happening there, but we know that those people can be reached, young people can be reached through the schools. So really talking about what are normal aspects of interaction, how do you manage when you see, so we call like bystander interventions, where when you see something, say something, understanding that this is a harm, and if it's getting perpetuated, that there are ways that families can get supports they need for it to stop, that communities can have supports that they need to stop. Those are really key elements. And just to remember that, you know, there was a lot of effort put towards bullying prevention programs in schools. I hear less about that now. We do know that harassment and bullying starts to elevate in middle school. Particularly harassment in the forms of things like sexual harassment and sexual bullying. We need to catch that earlier, because that's the kind of stuff that just, it continues to increase. And we know that schools that are affected by this are more likely to have more students affected by this. In other words, if you go to a school and you see one student affected, you're going to probably see more than one student affected, because there is that social transmission element.
Do you think people who have experienced violence, that this is something that they carry with them every day, that they are living in fear of further violence, and this impacts them in almost all their behaviors and attitudes and the way that they see the world?
I think two things. I think that too much of this, it becomes normalized. And so people, you know, that's why we use the term survivors. They survive it. But that doesn't mean it's not taking a toll, particularly a mental health toll. Sometimes that can affect use of substances. I think, you know, our data shows that violence early in life can affect you over the course of a lifetime. At the same time, you know, we also know that, I'll give you an example of sexual harassment. When it's so ubiquitous, it doesn't mean it doesn't affect you. It just means you now just expect it. You know, that's what it is. That's just what it is for a 20-year-old who's out and about in the city or in society in some way.
Well, some people say violence is part of life. We should just be able to figure out how to live with it.
Well, you know, I guess if you want to view it that way, then I guess mental health trauma, loss of economic wages, a hit on your tax base is also something you're going to want to live with. So I'm probably not the best person to say I'm going to be a proponent of that. I think the cost, the economic cost to our societies, the human toll it takes, the, as you mentioned, the intergenerational aspects, it's not something we have to live with. It's something we can change. I want to remind people that violent crime has gone down. Look at what it was in the 80s and 90s. It has gone down. We can change this. What I don't think we've sufficiently tackled is a lot of the ways it continues to happen in our households, in the context of relationships, and particularly for, you know, adolescents, young adults, how it happens as a means of demonstrating, you know, sort of your ability to take care of yourself and your communities. And I don't think we have to keep living like that and forcing particularly young people to have to endure it.
So help me, you know, wrap this up with the takeaway, looking at what your findings in Texas, comparing to the two other states that you've done similar snapshots with, Louisiana and California. What do you see as the standout takeaways from your findings?
So, again, violence is ubiquitous. It's affecting most people in Texas, and it's creating a, you know, it's contributing to the mental health crisis, and it does have an impact on social well-being and your economy. It is something, violence prevention needs to be a priority. I think that's number one. Number two, and this is really, I think, specifically what I'm seeing in Texas, something is going on with violence against women that is not consistent with what I'm seeing in other states in terms of it happening at a higher prevalence, even than what we're seeing for men. And that is something that bears further attention. I am working with some great organizations in Texas now, coalitions focused on domestic violence and sexual violence. We need to understand better why this violence is so high for women in Texas, and it's happening at equivalent levels of what we're seeing with men. But for the case of women, it's more likely to be happening in their homes, from their partners, from the people that they're romantic and sexually involved with. And if you can't be safe with the person that you're, you know, sharing a life with, where could you ever be safe?
Is there a hotline, or how can people address this?
Yes, there are coalitions and local services that address experiences of violence. But the easiest way to get attachment to the services for domestic and sexual violence is to call the 988 number. That's for mental health, and it'll help you link into the services, and that's going to work anywhere in the state.
So it's like 911, but it's 988.
988.
Anita Raj is the executive director of Tulane University's Newcomb Institute. She led the Texas Violence Experiences Survey. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Texas primary for the midterm election is going to be here sooner than you might think.
The election day is March 3rd. Early voting begins on February 17th, and the deadline to register to vote is February 2nd. Because of the increased importance of this midterm, because of the battle over the control of Congress, many new voters are expected to participate. However, due to changes at the post office, many of those new potential voters may not be able to make that deadline. Natalia Contreras is a reporter for VoteBeat and is covering the issue.
The U.S. Postal Service changed some of their policies last month. And so, you know, whenever you drop off something in the mail, either outside in one of those blue mailboxes or you go inside and drop it off, it doesn't necessarily mean that those envelopes of that mail is going to be postmarked that day, because it depends like what time you drop it off, first of all. So that is essentially what they're saying, is that not just because somebody drops off their mail on a specific day doesn't mean it's going to be postmarked that day. And so what that means for voters, especially in Texas, is that if you are waiting until the last minute to mail in your voter registration application, and that deadline is coming up here February 2nd, if you, you know, just forgot, you got things going on and you remember, okay, it's the last day, the best thing to do because of these new policies is to walk into the post office and request that they postmark it for that day, so that whenever it's received by county official, they'll have that notice that you did it by the deadline, and it'll be, you know, it'll be processed on time. And so basically that is the number one thing that voters have to know, is that if it's just too close to the deadline and they're mailing in either a voter registration application or an application to vote by mail, if it's done really too close to the deadline, it would be recommended that they walk into the office and request that postmark so that they're sure that it's going to be received and processed on time. And of course, as you know, this is important for voters to know, especially new voters, because Texas doesn't have online voter registration. And if they want to vote in this March primary election, that deadline is coming up February 2nd. That application is going to have to be mailed in or turned in person to the county elections office. And time is running out for us to do that. Another thing to keep in mind when it comes to this process that we have is that if there's an issue with either your voter registration application or with your mail-in ballot application, if you're wanting to get a mail-in ballot, the later you turn it in, the less time that county officials have to mail something to you to say, hey, there's a mistake, you need to fix something on your application. So there's just multiple things to consider here. But the very first one is, you know, the fact that we don't have online voter registration in the state, and these applications have to be mailed in. And then, of course, they have to be processed manually by election officials in our counties. And so we really have to think that time is of the essence here.
So the Postal Service, they made this change. We've seen some other things happen with the Postal Service in the past that some people claimed were suspicious and may have been a shadowy effort to interfere in elections. Does this fall under that category, or is this just the fact that the Postal Service has got to make some changes?
No, I don't think that falls into this category. These are just changes that they're making. It's just that in Texas, it affects us more because of what I just mentioned. It's the fact that we still are dealing with a process that's paper-based. We're still relying so much on the mail. And I mean, the U.S. Postal Service, there's been suspicious claims out there, but the U.S. Postal Service, just like any other type of fundamental organization out there that we so heavily rely on. I mean, there's things that happen, right? Like we have a really bad winter storm coming up here this weekend. Is the mail going to be behind? Yes, the mail is always behind. Are we even going to look at our mail if we get anything? You know, it's just, it takes time. It's just the process that we have in Texas, the problem is that if we rely in our state heavily on it when it comes to voter registration and when it comes to voting by mail, of course.
Right. And I should just mention here that there is no good reason that we don't have an online way to register to vote. That's just something that the state does. But so there's another development that you have been covering. So a federal judge on Tuesday dismissed a lawsuit filed by a conservative activist who challenged the use of electronic voting equipment to randomly number ballots in Texas on grounds that it was a way that it kind of broke the ballot secrecy promise that we have?
Yes. And that is just to kind of prep everyone out there that's listening. That's a topic that's very into the weeds of election administration and elections. But yes, it's related to our...
When you went to go vote, it could be suddenly it was kind of like you pick a ballot. You know, you had to, they scrambled the ballots and, you know, it was kind of like pick one that's kind of spread out on the table as a way to kind of like scramble the numbers. And so that was a remedy that was put out there because of this allegation that someone could look at these numbered ballots and be able to figure out who voted on for what. And now what happened?
Yeah, that was the challenge there. And just for some context too, numbering of ballots is something that we still do in Texas. And the reason that is it's for auditing purposes, right? Like you want to account for everything in an election. But election experts across the nation have moved away from adding any type of number to ballots because of this, because of what you're mentioning, because it could be tied back to a voter. But honestly, in Texas, the numbering of ballots and the shuffling of ballots really isn't the numbering, that issue specifically really isn't what's putting our ballot secrecy at risk here. What has been, and that's what, you know, the plaintiffs in this case were challenging, that the way that we're numbering our ballots, the fact that they're not ran, the fact that they are not listed sequentially, like all of these different things, it was their claim, right? But what's really has been putting our ballot secrecy at risk here in our state in some instances is the fact that we make a lot of election records public and available to the public. Anything from images of ballots to anything you can imagine. I mean, the equipment and like what type of equipment was used and the brand of the equipment and like anything you can imagine that's elections related or that was used to run the election could be requested by anyone. And so Texas has made it easier for the public to access any and all types of records that has put some folks at risk of their ballot being, you know, available. It doesn't happen. It's not as easy as you would think. You will have to be really, 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 really involved and really deep into elections to even know what to request, right? What documents or what type of information to request to figure that out. But it's still something that our state has made a lot easier.
Natalia Contreras is a reporter for VoteBeat. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find Texas Matters wherever you download cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.